We're on number 6, which is Zionism and Religious Significance of the State of Israel, the Zionist Vision of Yirmiyahu and Zechariah. I've taken opportunities to include Tanakh topics in our discussions. Okay. And let's get this here. Let's talk about 2 weeks from today, okay? Okay. Have it. Now, right after your page, it says Unit 6. There is a page that looks like this. It says the Zionist Vision of Yirmiyahu, chapter 31. Right? And it has 20 lines in it. 20 different elements of a biblical essence of Zionism that comes through. Okay? I would submit to you that the terminology actually stems from this chapter. What's the origin of the word Sion used at first? No. Today's October 31st. We're taping Jewish engagement. We're on Unit 6. And the terminology is used first by David. David referred to his capital city, Yerushalayim, as Ir Sion. Why? What does it mean? So you ever take a particularly good report or assignment or a test, and your third grade teacher wrote at the top Mitsuyan, right?
Yeah.
Or what we call a grave marker. A grave marker is called a Tsiyun Kvarot. What do all these words have in common? Tsiyun, Mitsuyan, and to be a Zionist. Certainly where the word stems from is something outstanding, something that takes your imagination or your makes an impression upon you. Okay. The word Mitsuyan probably translates, usually they say excellent paper. No, Mitsuyan means outstanding. Why is it Tsiyun Kvaros called that? Why do we call a tombstone a Tsiyun? Right? If we look at how the Gemara knows that we're supposed to set up a Tziyun, you'll figure it out. What does it say? What does it say in the Torah that when you bury someone, you have to put up a marker? For whom? For what purpose? Not everyone in this class, just maybe a few of you. Who is it for? How do you know that you're supposed to put up a Tziyun? The Gemara Mordechai says, because l'fnei iver lo sitein michshol. Not for the stumbling block before the Kohanim, who might walk there and make themselves common. So therefore, what we see is that it's Siyun is a marker. It's supposed to mark something. Now we use it to make so that I can go back to my relative's place and know where they are and pray there and say a prayer there or something, right? Okay. Okay, but here is the line. In Yo chapter 31... is really a unique chapter in Tanakh, because the other 51 chapters in this book are all just basically about destruction. Right? Hashem tells Yirmiyahu, your message is Lintosh, Lintot, Lahavik, Laharos. Your message is to destroy, to demolish, to uproot, and to utterly lay waste, but also to rebuild and replant. In this political season, you know what a Jeremiad is? Have you heard the word? A Jeremiad. It's an English word. A Jeremiad. This my opponent is hurling Jeremiads at this country. No one, you know what it is? Look it up. Jeremiad. Translate what it says there.
A long mournful complaint or lamentation in the list of
List of woes, lamentation. I mean, that's pretty much everything politicians say these days is Jeremiah of what's going to happen if you elect my opponent, right? It's not fair that why not call it an Amoseh or something, or a Jeremiah gets this. Well, when you have a book of 52 chapters and 51 of them are all about tearing down and demolishing, okay, what do you expect? All right, but at the end of those four words, he says, we'll give notes for the Torah. I'm also going to rebuild and replant. That's what chapter 31 is about in Yirmiyahu. Okay? While you're allowed to learn, say for Yirmiyahu on Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to learn chapter 31. It's the Haftorah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. I'm sure not everyone has time. Not allowed to learn chapter 31 of Sefer Yirmiyahu on Tisha B'Av because it's joyful. It's the one chapter of surrounded by such destruction that is really upbeat, beautiful chapter, and it mentions that speaking to the people in Galus about their return, and it says, in order to return, Hatsivi Loch Tziyunim, set up markers so that you know how to get back. As they're marching you up north, put stakes in the ground. Mountain climbing or probably hiking, and you're running through a lot of trees, and they put there's a blue dot on the tree, and then you reach this tree, and you got to look for the next blue dot, right? So down there, you got to look around. Sometimes they have different colored dots, determining different types of trails. The yellow dot is an easy trail. The orange dot is a difficult trail, right? You know what I'm talking about? So that's what this tziyunim are. Set up these markers so that you know, okay, now I'm lachish now. Okay, now I'm going to turn to Katsor. And I'm going to go, the bonfires that they set to determine Rosh Chodesh, right? So Yirmiyahu warns them, when you leave this place, they're going to take you out of this place, set up these markers. Hatsivi loch tziyunim, so you know how to get back. So now tell me, simply, one sentence, what is a Zionist? Someone who thinks Jerusalem is remarkable. Someone who sets up these markers and intends to come back. That's it. I mean, people use it for all kinds of meanings. But that's what it is. It's someone who considers, wherever I live in Uganda, I live in Madagascar, what do those two countries have in common, you know?
Uganda, they proposed.
Yes, both those countries were proposed as homelands for the Jewish people in the 19th century. All right, we agree, Jews need a place to be. Here's where it is. Right? It's correct. Jews need a new place where they can escape when they're persecuted around the world. Okay? So the Zionist says, no, it's got to be here. What's so special about this place? All right, look at this. There's some history here. You know, Abraham did certain things here, you know. David set up his kingdom here. Right. So that is in its ikar meaning, the word refers to this prophecy of Yirmiyahu. But it goes far beyond this. I have that's one of these 20 items here that identifies the Zionist. Okay, so have this list in front of you. And now we're going to turn to the pages in this chaveret. Guys, have it in front of you. If you're not having it from me, just might as well just go. You need to have these pages in front of you. Right? About five or six of them. And it actually comprises all of unit six in the chaveret. Right?
Is this something you handed out?
No. It's in the large chaveret. Okay. It says, Biblical Motifs of Returning, Jeremiah 31, as a Rosh Hashanah theme.
This is under Unit 6?
Yes, it's all of Unit 6. Okay. Okay. Now, you probably daven in a shul where they are somewhat Zionist, most modern Orthodox Jews. That part of what defines our modern orthodoxy is a certain approach we have to the state of Israel. Do you agree that this might be one of them? How we approach women in scholarship, how we approach relations with the Gentiles, how we approach the study of academia. This is what makes up this course, right? some of these topics, so you have to come. Right? So you're probably davening in a shul where they say a bracha from Medinas Yisrael, can any of you start it off for us? Avinu Shebashamayim, Tzur Yisrael, B'Golalo. Orech et Medina Yisrael, Reshit Tzmichat Yehulatim. That's how we say it in my shul. But that's not how Rav Soloveitchik said it, and that's not how Rav Lamb said it. They both added a word. One word. And I love it when I have a rabbi visiting to my shul where we have a speaker for Yom HaTzmahut or something, and they say, they get up to say this, and they impose their derech without asking first. I usually tell them, listen, here we say Reshit Tzmichat Yehulatim. We say, bless the state of Israel that is the first sproutings of our redemption. What is the word that some add? Say it in English if you want. Bless the state of Israel. In English it's two or three words. Shetehe reishit tzmichat yudotem. You gathering in this difference? In other words, they don't think that Israel is the Reshit Tzmichat Yehulatim now. I haven't asked Rabbi Lamb about this since he wrote about this. I assume he still feels, I don't know what has happened in the last 30 or 40 years to change someone's mind. But in the late 60s, after the Six-Day War, he said, how are we to be so arrogant as to think that the state of Israel is God's first sprouting of redemption? The purpose of the rest of this class is to try to answer that question. Rav Soloveitchik felt very strongly about that. In a very, very public forum, right after the Six-Day War, at the RCA convention in upstate New York, Rav Soloveitchik said that he would favor giving up the Kotel, giving it up, I don't like to say giving it back, giving it up to the Jordanians if it would save lives. I think it's quite naive to think that that is the case, but no, he wasn't favoring to relinquish it. He just said that if the generals would determine, and it's not for the rabbis to determine, we're not up on all of the latest reasons to think one way or the other. But if the people, the politicians, and the general people are hired to make this decision, people are elected and hired to determine whether this is so, draw the conclusion that it is so, then he would favor it. Right? Remember, this is after a few weeks earlier, after 2,000 years, the Kotel is in our hands. Right? So if Soloveitchik said it's arrogant on our part, remember this is only about 20 years after the state of Israel has been declared, right? It's arrogant on our part to say publicly that the state of Israel is God's way of showing us the redemption. I'm sure that the Satmar don't care whether Israel is run 100% according to the halacha or not. Right? It's still pushing away the Mashiach's time. I'll explain why in a minute. Or sometime today or Thursday. But I'm not sure, maybe Rav Soloveitchik might have felt that if Israel was run in some kind of halakhic fashion, right, was closer to a Torah type of society, maybe he would have felt that that's closer to a messianic manifestation. Yes?
Or do you disagree with Rav Soloveitchik?
So here, because... it's not me. I'm siding with those who disagree.
Yes, or
the religious Zionist, Rav Kook and others, well before he enunciated Rabbi Lamb and Rabbi Soloveitchik enunciated these positions, they felt that the statement Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu is in and of itself enough of a disclaimer for us to have the chutzpah to determine what God's plan is. Soloveitchik and Rav Lamb were very good students of history, and they knew very well that in the 13th century, approximately 400 families of Balei HaTosfos, 400 families, significant amount of people, made their way to Israel. Very dangerous trip, very, very arduous, very expensive. About 400 families made their way to Israel. The Christians and the Muslims were duking it out for hundreds of years over who would administer the land of Israel. Neither of them ever building it up and conquering it very well. When the Christians conquered it, they killed every Muslim and every Jew they got their hands on. We have the diaries of some of those soldiers, very gruesome, of what they did to Christians and what the Christians did to Muslims and Jews. When the Muslims conquered Israel, they killed every Christian and begrudgingly sometimes allowed Jews to remain under very, very downtrodden status. don't be so surprised that that we don't talk about this. That program down on Fifth Avenue. You know what I'm talking about? Met. There's a Jerusalem festival now. It's the year 1000 to 1400. It's called Every People Under Heaven. And if you went through it, and I'm not taking my show, it's going to be this coming Monday, going on the tour of it, you would think that Jerusalem is 45% Muslim, 50% Christian, and 5% Jewish. That's generous to the Jews. Because what were Jews doing between 1000 and 1400 besides getting killed in Jerusalem? Right? Okay, I'm saying it doesn't really. There's nothing about the Crusades, at least in specific detail, short of just mentioning it. Right? What can I say? But I think it's still worthwhile. I'm taking the show to see it just so we can lay our eyes on it. But I'm just saying that when these 400 families made their way to Israel, don't you think the same rhetoric was going on? And they were all saying this is Rishis Mikuzim. They didn't use that terminology, but they thought that this is surely the harbinger of the Messianic age. And some Jews were acting irresponsibly as a result. Turn for a few hundred years later, 1666, what's happening then? Who's 6 plus 12 is 1665. Shabtai Tzvi, right? Everyone was sure that this is it. Right? People were selling their homes all over Europe. With nothing but a little deed in their hands, with a trip to Israel, knowing that when they get there, we'll finally get the Muslims and Christians will finally get there what they deserve in Israel. Right? How'd that go? It was unfortunate for us that 1665 was just around the time when Christians also thought that the second coming of Jesus was supposed to come. And amazingly, it's a Muslim prediction as well. That for their 12 imams to come. Right? Shia position. So, be that as it may, Rav Lamb thought it was arrogant of us to without prophetic visions, without anything to declare otherwise, that we're just making the same mistake they made in 1300 and 1666, and we might be making the same mistake now.
So, Rav Lamb had the same opinion as the Rav?
Rav Lamb, yes, the same, basically the same opinion. I put them together. I'm not asking for two different positions on that question.
Right. Just they differ. The Rav Lamb was more focused on history.
Rav Lamb is much more in writing from Rav Lamb on the top. Rav Soloveitchik wrote a very important work we're going to discuss shortly. It's called Kol Dodi Dofek. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
Translated. Kol Dodi Dofek, based on a pasuk in Shir HaShir. Right? Chapter 5 of Shir HaShir. We'll have to run through that chapter, of course. And I'm going to make a pretty wild claim. Here you have Yirmiyahu Lamed Aleph and Shir HaShir Hey on the same page. Right? It's on the second page of Unit 6. Right? And I'm going to make a wild claim that when Yirmiyahu wrote chapter 31 of his book, describing the return, Rashi says that it's his favorite parsha, its favorite parak in Tanakh. That when Yirmiyahu described his return to Israel after the 70-year exile, that he had Shir HaShirim chapter 5 open in front of him. That he was using a narrative of Shir HaShirim in order to describe the return. That's why Rav Soloveitchik called his book on the Jewish return, Kol Dodi Dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking at the door. He thinks it's something. Knocking at the door is nothing. Right? God's knocking at the door today. I'm writing in 1960, and God's knocking at the door. Right? But he said it's not enough to call it Rishis Michas Gulasena. My response is that, it's not a religious Zionist response, is that Rishis Michas Gulasena was quite a caveat. Do you hear it? I'm not calling it Berichet Medinat Yisrael Shehi Geulatenu, and I'm not calling it Reishit Geulatenu. Right? I'm calling it Reshit Tzmichat Geulatein. I'm not calling it the sproutings of our redemption. I'm not calling it the beginning of our redemption. I'm calling it the beginning of the sproutings of our redemption. Why do we use the word sproutings? Isn't that a little strange? Well, Where else do we call it that every day? Hello? 3 times a day! Okay, the word tzemach appears 3 times in that book. Alright, so let's turn the question on Shemoneh Esrei. Why does Shemoneh Esrei refer to our redemption as tzemach David? Alright, so this, that I thought you should know, but this I don't think you'll know, is that two prophets refer to that time as a tzmicha. The two prophets are, well, look at your question. Look at the question. Describe Yirmiyahu and Zechariah's Zionistic vision. There you go. This could be a segue to another topic in our discussion, but Yirmiyahu refers to a messianic figure as Tzemach Tzadik. That's why it's such a popular Lubavitch name. Add to that Ibn Ezra, who despises Gematria. Ibn Ezra says, we all thought that Mashiach's name is Menachem. Right? But Menachem is the same Gematria as Tzemach. Yirmiyahu refers to Mashiach as a Tzemach Tzadik. Zechariah says his name is Tzemach. This is Yirmiyahu Chav Gimel. Zechariah Gimel. He says Shmo Tzemach. Alright? Tzemach Shmo, he says. His name is Tzemach. Of all names, that's Mashiach's name, Tzemach? Because Tzemach is a growth, it's a sprouting. Why do the prophets use this terminology for Mashiach's arrival? But this here, this might be, I might have to ask our soccer friends, how do you explain that you feel that Mashiach's arrival will be replete with miracles, without a doubt to anyone who witnesses it, right? And it'll happen quite quickly. Alright, on this there's going to be some debates. What is a tzemach? You ever see a tzemach grow? No. Unless you're watching a very quick moving video that runs 4,000 times faster per second. And you can see the flower actually, rather than falling off. You ever see such a thing? Tzemach grows slowly. What's the point? Come on. That Mashiach's arrival comes in stages. It's stages. It doesn't happen all at once. Right? And sometimes you may even move backwards a little bit, then move forwards afterwards. Backwards a little bit, and then forwards after. Right? It's not going to be a... Oh, here it is! Okay. So, this is why we say Reishis Tzmichas Gilosenu. Why we say Etzemach David Adduchamir Azutzmiach. Because Yirmiyahu and Zechariah both refer to the Messianic arrival as Etzemach. Now, we can get off on a tangent. Yechezkel, chapter 36, refers to 2 Messianic arrivals. Oh, what do you think Christians do with this? First coming and the second coming. But he says that one is from Shevet Yehuda and one is from Shevet Yosef, Shevet Ephraim. Zator, anyone here by Mitzvah Parsha Vayigash? Where Yehuda and Yosef confront each other? So here is where Yehuda and Yosef, 2 trees. You have 2 trees. He says, take a tree and write the name. He says, David for Yehuda and Yosef. Okay. Haftorah Beigash, Haftorah of the 8th day of Pesach in Chutz La'aretz, is Yeshayahu saying, "V'yotza choter mi geza yishai." shoots shall come out from the roots of Yishai, and Mashiach shall sprout from that. See what's going on here? Zechariah, Haftar of Hanukkah. There's two trees. With hundreds and hundreds of tubes leading into a menorah. The trees are olive trees. The tubes, how is this a Hanukkah vision? It's the Haftar of Hanukkah. It shows that the oil will never depart from the menorah. Even if I have to bring tubes from trees, there will always be a way to get the oil. Right? Even if I have to make a miracle, that it'll last longer, whatever it is. Okay? So, Yizchariah looks at this vision and says to God, I don't really understand what I'm seeing, God. What is it? Explain to me. What is this vision? What do these two trees represent? So God answers, Shnei B'nei HaYitzhar. Two sons of oil. Mashiach means anointed with oil. Mashkan Aramaic means oil. They are the two sons of oil. You see, we don't have two comings. What do we have? Two Mashiachs. If you have two different descriptions of Mashiach, one where he's quite glorious, Daniel, one where he's coming as a man of poverty, Zechariah. So Christians say, okay, Zechariah is the first coming, Daniel is the second coming. Right? How do we explain it? Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Why should we have two Mashiachs? Explain, historically, why would we have two Mashiachs? Moshe Dayan claimed to be the Mashiach ben Yosef. The Vilna Gaon said his students were Mashiach ben Yosef. What do they have in common? What is why Yosef? Why not Mashiach ben Zvulun? Come on, talk to me. Yes?
When is the physical land?
I would entertain such a thought if the other answer wasn't so patently obvious. Come on, what's Yosef and Yehuda? What is Yehuda? Why was Yechezkel talking about? There were two kingdoms of Israel. One always ruled by a descendant of David. One always ruled by a descendant of Yosef. The two kingdoms had two Mashiachs. Right? Mashiach and Yosef comes first. Paved the way for Mashiach ben David. That's why the Vilna Gaon said the students from Mashiach ben Yosef. Those who go to Israel to build up the land so that it will be ready for those who will bring it back to its old status, those people preparing it are Mashiach ben Yosef. People doing the final work lead into an individual who is Mashiach ben David. But the Vilna Gaon thought that which the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef is not necessarily an individual person. Moshe Dayan felt that he fulfilled the role of Mashiach ben Yosef. Quite amazing. It's interesting because in Yaakov's blessing, he refers to Yosef as the one Alei Ayin, with one eye. I don't recall his writings that he used that as a sign. You know, he had one eye, he had a patch on one eye. So it's interesting. But he claimed to be Mashiach ben Yosef as the one preparing for our messianic aspirations, so to say. Okay, so this explains this aspect of it. Now, let's go back to Shir HaShir. Okay, number one says, understand the long historical aspirations of the nation of Israel. Shir HaShirim in parentheses. So, did we discuss Shir HaShirim? Did we touch upon it? The woman in bed when her lover comes to the door. Alright, well, just a brief overview. So, the woman is in bed, says, Ani Yishena, will be air. I mean, I'm sleeping, but my heart is awake. How could you be sleeping and awake at the same time? Oh, it's not a restful sleep, right? Everybody understand what Shir HaShirim is? It's a metaphor between God and His people. The woman is Israel, the man in the story is God. It's not a happy book. It's the saddest book in Tanakh because these two people never actually meet, Right? What could be sadder than two people who are in love who never get to actually do anything about it? It seems that every time the man is interested in the woman, she's playing hard to get. When the woman is interested in the man, he says, "Where were you when I wanted you?" And the book ends by saying, "Just stay loyal to me. When I'm ready, I'll come back to you." Sad, right? Right? Did it happen to you that way? When you're finally interested in her, she says, "Sayonara, I've already seen someone else." Right? So she's lying in bed. Kol do di do fake. I hear my beloved's voice. And this is his voice. Pitchili achoti rayati yonati tamati. Open up for me, my beloved. Using a lot of terminology and nicknames for each other. Shiroshinim latol, Kutsa Cyrus, he say Lila. My head is filled with the rains of the night. Why do we care if it's raining or not? Why is it raining outside? Why is that part of the story? He's coming to finally indicate his love for his beloved. She's in bed, a place of love, and he's knocking at the door. And she refuses to open up to him. And part of the statement is, "It's raining out here, let me in." Right? No? So, why is it raining? Simply, I'm not asking for big Torah here. Okay. It's raining. He's just telling her the rain didn't keep me from coming here. I didn't look for conveniences in not making it here. I left my place. I'm going outside. It's raining. It's cold. Let me in. Right? She's about to refuse because of her inconvenience. But I inconvenienced myself to get to you. Why won't you inconvenience yourself to open up for me? Okay? One thing. If you hear this is a Musar, but there's a Pasuk in Mishlei that says, "Omar Otzeo Ari Bachutz." The lazy man says there's a lion outside. That's exactly the quote. The lazy man says there is a lion outside. So the Bali Musar asked, "Is there really a lion outside?" This is, calls up his Rebbe. He says, "Rebbe, I know I told you I'd pick you up, but there's a lion sitting on my porch. I can't come." Clover said, "Listen, I know I told you I was going to drive you to that wedding you were going to go to, but there's a lion sitting in my porch." All right? Now, that lion is obviously a metaphor. Give me examples, your modern examples.
Traffic.
It's traffic, good. I have a flat tire. I stuck my toe. I don't know, whatever else, you know what I'm saying? So we make excuses. But is the excuse real or is it fake? Because if it's a fake excuse and the lion really isn't in front of his house, don't you think Mishlei is being a little kind to this person by calling him lazy? What should we call him if it's not there? He's a liar, he's a schlub, right? He's despicable. To say I can't come to your wedding because there's a fictional lion in front of my house? Why are you giving him the benefit of the doubt, calling him lazy? He's worse. Okay, so the lion is there. So why are you calling him lazy? Now answer my question. No? And what, I'm talking about this at Shirim 5. Open the door for me, my beloved. What's the... And she's about to say, "I can't, the floor is muddy. It's cold. I'm under the covers. I'm so comfortable. And I'm standing here in the rain. Open up for me." Right? What excuse could you make that the lion is in front of your house? Because of what? Because you don't want to, I don't know, figure it out. But I guarantee you this. If you had tickets to Game 6 of the World Series, you'd go. Well, I don't know if any of you had a dog in this race. My son just married a girl from Chicago. But if you had tickets to the World Series, tickets to a concert you really want to go to, if there was 10 poisonous snakes in front of your house, you'd get out. You'd do something about it. You'd go out the back window. You'd shoot them. Right? Stop making excuses. The only person interested in your excuses is your competition. Get out there and make it happen. All right? So he knocks on the door. He says, "Open up for me, my beloved." And what does she say? I'm already wearing my night clothes. You get it? The night clothes is, it's all a metaphor. The bed is our comfort in Chutzlaretz. The night clothes is our gullus garb. We all have our villas, we all have our big apartments, we all have whatever it is that we're comfortable with, right? Yeah, I'm the biggest liar of all. Here I am talking in Chutzlaretz, just the same. How can I get dressed for my geula? Come on. I know it's raining outside. My floor is all muddy. Right? I wash my feet. How am I going to get them dirty? Opening the door for you. He's not taking no for an answer. So he still threatens, if I get to get in, this is a good door to use it, to explain. Dodi shalach yodom min achor. He pushed his hand through an opening of the door to open it, you know, he's outstanding on this, open it from the side. You get it? You understand? So she sees the hand of God. This is also metaphorical. She sees her beloved's hand. She says, whoa, umei ai hamu alav. I had butterflies in my stomach for him. Umei ai means my innards, my intestines, probably. Hamu means started to flutter over seeing the hand of my beloved. Really? Why didn't you just open the door when he asked you to? So she starts running out of bed. Kamti ani, liftoach ledodi. And if you know your Shir HaShirim, what does it mean if they actually meet and embrace and consummate their love? That means that that's our geula. Right? Kamti ani, liftoach ledodi. I ran out of my bed to get the door. His hand was trying to get the door. So I said, let me help you with that. I'm going to get the door for you. But you know what? The etzvosai mor over al kapos hamanul. I'm sorry, the adinat fumor, the etzvosai mor over al kapos hamanul. But I had myrrh. Myrrh is like dippity-doo that you went cooking in your hair and the women wear overnight. So that by the morning, their hair is all made up appropriately, right? In other words, she went to bed considering waking up to her beloved, right? That's not so. That's very easy when the sun is shining, when everything is nice and it's not raining. How about when it's raining and the floor is muddy and it's not so easy? Right? So she went to bed thinking that she's going to stay in bed and in a nice, comfortable surroundings for a good long time. So when she suddenly went out of bed to get the door, what's happening? All that myrrh, which is symbolic of her satisfaction to be in the gullus for a good long time, started getting all over her hands. With these, you know, the curlers and dippity dunno, whatever you call this stuff. It's just, it's getting all over, and then she fiddles for the handle of the lock, and she can't open it because her hand is stepping on it. And by the time she finally opens the door, you have what I think are the three saddest words in the Tanakh. The Dodi Chomak Ovah. I just had the opportunity and God. So what did she do? She runs outside to talk to him. Because she belongs to Sue. She runs outside. Wait a second. She's dressed in night clothes. It's nighttime. What do you think is likely to happen to a woman like this? She gets abused by all the men, the watchmen outside. And then they ask her, What are you doing outdoors like this at night? What are you searching for? And she describes at length, like, you know, from Shira Shira, she describes her beloved, all his body parts, and how wonderful he is, right? He does it to her, also in the book, right? So she describes L'chayov, Yadov, Shokov, Amidov, his cheek, his hair, his aunt, right? So when they hear all of these things, they said, what? This now goes into chapter 6. Christians made up the chapter numbers. I would have kept this as part of the end of chapter 5. The watchmen who abused her, they say to her, Ana halachto decha yafa banashim. Where did he go? How did you let him out of your grasp? What you just described is appealing to us as well. Ana panato dechu nevakshena imach. Let's go look for him also. And that's where the famous Anidu Dodi comes from. Please, someone save me today. and just tell me that you can tell me what this represents, this desire of the watchman to search for her beloved together with her. How did you let this... What you just described, go not answer the door for him? Come, let us find him with you. What does that represent historically in the last 2,000 years?
Trying to reach out to Hashem. And
by?
By whatever you're doing.
Us?
Other religions.
Other religions. The other nations of the world. The ones who abused us. Right? Okay, Ruth Wissy, I'm not pronouncing her name, Wissy or Weiss, but I think it's Wissy. She's the head of the Yiddish department at Harvard. She's a really brilliant woman. She wrote an article about 15 years ago on sense of Christianity and Islam as opposed to other religions and other pagan systems. It's very simple. It's because those systems were guided by immorality. They were guided by strength and security and success, but they weren't moral. So when if a Jew or 500,000 Jews were chained to slave ships to take them and scatter them all over the world, right? They knew that they would outlast the people who are enslaving them now, because they are immoral and we are moral. We have a moral God who cares about their morality. And if we are punished now, it's because we slipped into immorality. Immorality got us into this mess, morality will get us out. Until Christianity and Islam conquered us. Because they decided, at least in their creeds, that they also are interested in morality. But if they slip into immorality, that will make them weak too. Right? That's what she wrote something to them. It was an interesting concept. Here is the point, that at the end of chapter 5, and beginning of chapter 6, the nations of the world attempt to find this beloved of Israel along with them. Christianity and Islam does it slightly different ways, because Christianity, I'll tell you this, philosophically speaking, if you would say, talk to me about God, and you had a Roman Catholic priest, an Islamic imam, and a Rosh Yeshiva, answer that question, describe what we just said in 15 minutes, the Muslim and the Jew are going to sound very much alike. Just what that God expects of us may be different. But the nature of the God is going to be very similar. The Christian is going to be way off the rails compared to the other two. But that's just ironic, because the Christian reveres this book as a holy book. 100% every word in it is binding on them. It's just that it's binding in a different way. Not in actual action, but in their hearts or something. Whatever, you know, they differ about its interpretation. The Muslim does not revere. They revere some of the prophets in this book. They don't revere the book. Okay? So it's an interesting dichotomy. We're going to talk about that further. So this is what this part here represents. Okay? Now, this is what I would like you to do. If you go to chapter 31 of Yirmiyahu, on the top of this page, only got 10 books. If you don't have this page, you somehow can't get it. It's chapter 31, verse 14 to 21. Okay? Look for three... obvious, it's really obvious because I underline it, the three obvious examples of how Yirmiyahu had Shir HaShirim chapter 5 open in front of him when he wrote this chapter. There's some things you need to know, is that certain terminologies only appear in Yirmiyahu 31 and Shir HaShirim chapter 5, which is too coincidental to imagine. Right? Okay, that will cover us for this. We still have a lot more to do on Zionism, and we're going to discuss Rav Kook's positions and the Satmar and the Turikarta. Satmar and the Turikarta, and what are their positions in all of this? Please God, on Thursday.